I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, the real business of fantasy sports. But first, over the years, the NCAA has been criticized by sports writers, commentators, college athletes, and coaches. The current issue of the Atlantic Monthly features an article titled The Shame of College Sports, in which Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Taylor Branch discusses the dubious history and current endangered state of the governing body of college sports. Taylor Branch joins me now on the line. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill. Nice to be here.
The designation student-athlete is so familiar that people may not even wonder how the term came into being. You write that it was carefully chosen. What did those running the NCAA accomplish by designating college players, quote, student-athletes?
It was done in the early 1950s, according to Walter Byers, the head of the NCAA, who said it was explicitly codified and created to help defend the NCAA and colleges in lawsuits and workmen's compensation cases by injured athletes. Basically, colleges did not want to have to pay medical bills for particularly football players who broke their necks. So they created this term to resist workmen's compensation lawsuits, saying that the players were not really just players at the university. They were student athletes, which is this specialized category. It's a pretty cynical thing. I was surprised. I had no idea of this going in. But the courts have widely deferred to the NCAA and to the concept of amateurism.
You refer to, quote, two of the noble principles on which the NCAA justifies its existence, amateurism and student-athlete, as, quote, cynical hoaxes, legalistic confections propagated by the universities so they can exploit the skills and fame of young athletes. What are some of the particulars that led you to that conclusion?
Nearly everybody I talk to bridles at the idea of paying these student-athletes, and the principle by which we don't pay them is called amateurism, meaning we enshrine the notion that they're supposed to be amateurs and doing this for the sheer love of the game, and therefore they shouldn't want to be paid. But the problem with that is that to impose amateurism on someone else, you've got to have some sort of stronger basis. There is none in law. Nowhere is it illegal to pay college players or for college players to seek to be paid, since they're generating millions of dollars in income. It can only be done by a tradition or by a cartel or a conspiracy.
You found in the NCAA's governance system, quote, the unmistakable whiff of the plantation, end quote. But football and basketball players who are recruited by universities have aspired to be recruited. They know what they're getting into, don't they?
Well, certainly, but they don't have any alternative because the NCAA prohibits colleges from offering them any money and prohibits players from bargaining for their services. So it is a cartel in that sense. If you're a graduate teacher and you want to teach, the university can pay you to teach, and you can bargain for your salary. If you are an undergraduate and you want to work in the campus bookstore, you can bargain for your salary there. But if you're an athlete, not only can you not bargain for your salary above your scholarship, but you can't even bargain for the terms of your scholarship or anything else.
Over 25 years ago, the Supreme Court essentially eliminated the NCAA's stranglehold on college football. How has the organization been able to maintain control of the annual basketball tournament, which is the main source of the NCAA's income?
Only precariously. For its first 30 years, the NCAA controlled both all football contracts with television and all basketball. Then the football schools revolted, and they said, we don't want to do this. We want to control our own money. What saved the NCAA when the football schools revolted and took half their treasury was that it occurred right at the time when the March Madness basketball tournament was taking off, and its income skyrocketed 50-fold in 30 years. They now get $771 million directly in a check from the network, CBS Turner in this case, to the NCAA, which uses it to pay all the 1,000-member colleges and the winners of the tournament and the whole NCAA budget. 95% of its budget comes from this one tournament. And the NCAA's great fear is that the big football schools that took football away could take basketball away, too.
You suggest that stories about players receiving money and favors from boosters or players having their papers written for them distract us from a more significant issue, which you define as, quote, the denial of fundamental due process for college athletes. How do we address that?
Well, it is a legal question. Congress changed the Olympics. You know, the Olympics used to be as amateur as college sports.
Mm-hmm.
In 1978, Congress passed the Amateur Sports Act, which took the control of our Olympic teams away from the Amateur Athletic Union and gave them to 39 Olympic committees, each of whom allowed current athletes to have a voting stake in Olympic policy. And within 10 years, the Olympics went pro, not only in the United States, but around the world. The Olympic Committee expunged the word amateur from its charter in 1986. Michael Phelps can make millions of dollars and swim in the Olympics, but he couldn't swim on his team at the college team at the University of Michigan because the NCAA required him to be an amateur and not even appear at the meet.
Various studies produced by the Knight Commission and other groups have suggested ways in which the NCAA might be reformed. University presidents should take control of their athletic departments rather than letting them operate as separate entities. Stiffer penalties should be assessed against schools that break the rules, things like that. Has there ever been any real reform of the system?
The NCAA has made some effort in academic standards, in reforming schools on their graduation rates and things like that that don't really pertain to money, but have to do with academic standards.
Let's assume that the NCAA is reformed or that some of these changes that you're suggesting do occur. What would be the trickle-down theory on non-revenue sports that depend on football and basketball generating a lot of money for their very existence?
Well, we don't really know, but at least it would be an honest and acknowledged relationship. I don't know exactly how it would happen. Of course, if I were at a college, I'd be very loath to see the revenue sports gobble up all the others so that the only sports you offered were the ones that made money. There are a number of reformers who say that big money sports don't really belong in all of these schools. We're the only country in the world that houses big money sports in institutions of higher learning.
Assuming that college sports is going to continue to have a governing body, how should that body operate?
First of all, it should be open, and it should include the athletes themselves as members. One of the reasons that the student-athlete formulation worked back in the 1950s to set in motion this unfair structure is that the athletes are not members of the NCAA. They have no vote, they have no membership, they have no representation. It's only the institution. They should have some voting representation just as the Olympic athletes do. These kids are maintaining dual careers that are enormously demanding, both as students and as athletes. There may be a question whether it's practical to have professional sports and quality education coexist, but we don't have that debate right now because we're so diverted on all these phony scandals.
Pulitzer Prize winner Taylor Branch is the author of Parting the Waters, The Clinton Tapes, and many other books. His article titled The Shame of College Sports appears in the current issue of The Atlantic Monthly. Mr. Branch, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill. Enjoyed being with you.
To hear more of my conversation with Taylor Branch, please visit onlyagame.org and click on podcasts.